Hello, on this week's program we speak with artist Mark Dion. He's just spent 7 months retracing a four-year voyage made by the celebrated botanist William Bartram in the 1770s. An exhibition of art created by Dion from objects found on his journey opened at Bartram's Garden in West Philadelphia this week. Susan Lewis looks at the intersection of politics, business and the arts at the annual convention of Americans for the Arts in Philadelphia this weekend. And Jason Pfeiffer visits the DeMuth Foundation and Museum in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. The museum highlights the life and work of early 20th century painter Charles DeMuth, a lifelong resident of Lancaster who was educated in Philadelphia. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Last November, the artist Mark Dion left Philadelphia on a journey to retrace the historic trips of noted Philadelphia botanists John Bartram and his son William. The trip was the beginning of a project to create a site-specific art exhibition at Bartram's Garden, America's oldest living botanical garden in West Philadelphia. On the road, Dion collected specimens and man-made artifacts found in a landscape radically changed since the Bartram's travels 200 years ago. In keeping with Dion's long-standing interest in male art, along the way he sent his findings back to Bartram's Garden. Now, 7 months later, these artifacts, specimens and found objects are installed in souvenir cabinets designed and built for an exhibition in John Bartram's historic house that opened yesterday. On a sunny summer morning earlier this week, we took a walk through Mark Dion, Travels of William Bartram Reconsidered, and then spoke with the artist in the gardens. Remind us again of the thought process that went into putting this idea of what now is an exhibition together.
Well, you know, of course, I was very interested in William Bartram, and I think, you know, for me, he's such an important figure, not just in the history of natural history and the history of botany, but really in the history of American popular genres. And, you know, I think our greatest genre is really the travel genre. That's the one thing we really get right, and we do incredibly well. And, you know, that includes everything from Lewis and Clark to Easy Rider and Jack Kerouac. And, you know, and I think that its first formation, its first perfection is really in Bartram's travels. So reading that, I was just amazed at how much of that was in place, how much of the perfection of that genre is there in that book, and how much that undoubtedly inspired everyone after him. And I'm not a writer, and I don't make travel movies, and I'm not a person who works with a camera. So, you know, I'm really a sculptor. I'm a guy who's invested in material things. So I was interested in what could that genre be for me? What could that mean for someone who works with material? So it's not a travelogue, not a road movie, but a travel sculpture. And that's what this is, really. It's a way of using the museum as a model to explore how one represents travel through objects.
And quite a lot of objects you got. When you were leaving in November, I had this image of there being perhaps a small room with various found objects, various botanical samples. But there are thousands of things. I've just been through the exhibition, and it seems to be subdivided into two categories, the man-made and the organic.
Right, that's true. I mean, it's very much, what I like is that Bartram is a person really at this moment where you have the beginnings of Enlightenment science, and where the things that were interesting for the people who did the curiosity cabinets before, these kind of pre-Enlightenment collections, they mixed the artificial and the natural. And Bartram's generation are really the first that begin to tease out those two things as very different categories. So that's what this does. It you know, there is a kind of ethnographic collection, you might call it, a collection of material culture, and then there's a collection of the natural specimens, the things that Bartram would have primarily been sending back to England, seeds and plants and dried plants and things like that. So, and we did amass a huge collection of things. They're housed in cabinets that we've made, and so these cabinets, sometimes they're very small, but they represent weeks and weeks of traveling and scrounging and digging up roots and picking nuts and
going to flea markets. I know there's a lot of really lovely antique trinkets in one cabinet.
Absolutely, I am very much a flea market oriented person. I really am a continuation of that modern artist's interest in flea markets and in things that are discarded and things whose use has just passed. And In some of these places, it was very easy to access incredibly junk stores and flea markets and yard sales. And, you know, I can't possibly drive by a yard sale without screeching to a halt. So that impeded our progress in terms of landscape, but it certainly enriched our collection.
Tell me about the process of sending things back, because in this current atmosphere, most mail carriers, most courier services won't carry liquids, but yet you seem to have a vast collection of water samples, for instance.
Yeah, the water samples really come from some of the rivers that were really important to Bartram. Of course, a lot of the names of those rivers have changed, but rivers that he traveled on, rivers that he crossed, rivers that he had difficulty crossing, that he fished on, where he met with Native American trading groups, all of those, whenever we came across one of those, we would collect a water sample, put it in a mail sampling jar, you know, the kind that you might send a medical sample through, and at each post office, we were met with either incredible suspicion or disbelief, or, you know, sometimes very openly, and I would have to go in and explain the entire project. Sometimes it would get very complicated, open up the packages, show them that it was water, that it was nothing dangerous or hazardous or no biological weapons. So, you know, it is interesting how that culture of suspicion has really permeated America.
This is a collection, as we said earlier, of found objects. In the process of getting them back to Bartram's garden, was anything lost? And if so, anything significant to your mind?
There are a lot of things that were lost, and largely because in collecting specimens, and particularly when you're collecting things at the seashore, sometimes you collect them without knowing that there's something still in those shells. And so I think I drove the people here at the gardens mad with several incredibly stinky boxes. And we also, one of the things you find, I think, especially when you're traveling in Louisiana, is that the culture of magic, of superstition, is very, very strong. And we had found a gris-gris, a bottle filled with broken glass and someone's clothes with pins through it and saturated with urine, which the curator, Julie Courtney, dropped. And it smelled the house up here just tremendously for about 10 days.
And do you think you were breaking any spells or anything?
I would certainly hope that she helped someone out by having that accident.
What did you learn from this? Was this a learning process for you at all? Was it a learning experience?
You know, to me, travel is really the most profound way of knowing. It, you know, it really is very different from book learning. It's very different from other kinds of studying. It's very different from seeing a documentary about a place. It's very different from talking to people about a place. It engages all of your senses. And I think traveling is the most significant way of knowing. And I did learn a lot. I had particular ideas about what certain places looked like and was very surprised when they didn't conform to those. You know, I had imagined that Florida was from north to south, the Atlantic to the Gulf, one giant strip mall, and that's not the case at all. There's still huge areas of Florida which are beautiful and undeveloped and biologically and naturally rich landscapes. And it's just not what I anticipated encountering there was the entire western part of Florida, which is still beautiful and still has a lot of potential to be protected and preserved in an interesting way.
What's next? This has been quite an odyssey for you. Is this a path that you think artistically you'll continue to travel?
Well, with this project, you know, a lot of my interests coalesce. So my interest in the history of natural history, my interest in American history, in the culture of collecting, in museums and display. So in a sense, this is an ideal project. It's a kind of perfect storm of my interests and obsessions. So I feel very, very happy with the way this has worked and it's come together in a kind of profound way. So, you know, I'd like another opportunity to work in a similar vein, but, you know, there aren't other William Bartrams. I mean, he really is the guy who all of this exists in. He's the travel writer who is also a botanist, who is also an incredible draftsman and artist. And so that combination of things is it's rare to find someone as talented as he was and to have so many physical traces of him still existing in the world.
Artist Mark Dion. His Travels of William Bartram Reconsidered, curated by Julie Courtney, is at Bartram's Garden in West Philadelphia through December.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Born in 1883, the American painter Charles DeMuth generated about 1,000 works over the course of his lifetime. Yet while long recognized as a master watercolorist, his name has never carried much star power in his hometown of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. But since his death in 1935, that's been slowly changing. Now, as WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, a foundation and museum in downtown Lancaster continues to celebrate the life and works of this innovative painter.
The DeMuth Foundation and Museum was founded by the now 94-year-old Jerry Less, a former local journalist and longtime Lancaster resident. Less says he became conscious of the work of Charles DeMuth in the mid-1930s, while a student at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School.
I used to read Vanity Fair and a couple of other magazines of that type, and he was featured as a national, at that time, known artist. And it occurred to me that nobody in Lancaster knew about this man who was known throughout the country.
When he later moved back to Lancaster, Less found there were no DeMuth paintings on public exhibition anywhere in town. For years, this bothered Less, so in the early 1980s, he spearheaded an initiative to raise funds for the creation of a dedicated DeMuth Museum. The first order of business was purchasing one of the oldest buildings in Lancaster, the artist's King Street home and studio, where DeMuth lived for most of his life and died. This became the museum's home. In the beginning, Less says the foundation did not own any DeMuth artwork, but the donation soon came.
My wife at that time, Margaret, gave Charles's self-portrait, which she had bought at an auction sale for $2. So that gives you some idea of Lancaster's knowledge and respect for Charles the painter.
Any idea why that would be the case? That you mentioned that there was a little reluctance or lack of enthusiasm.
When he lived in Lancaster, he was more or less a recluse. He had a few favorite friends, but he did not circulate. His illness contributed to that.
DeMuth's health was perpetually frail. As a child, he suffered from lameness, and as an adult, from severe diabetes. But this didn't stifle his creativity, which his family recognized early on. They hired teachers to help nurture his artistic talent, and had the means to do so with a successful family business. Standing alongside the DeMuth home, the DeMuth Tobacco Shop was, and still is, a popular institution in Lancaster City. Started in 1770, it's the oldest operating tobacco shop in the country. As DeMuth grew older, he received training in Philadelphia at the Drexel Institute of Art, Science, and Industry and at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. He also traveled extensively, which enabled him to foster friendships with early 20th century luminaries like Georgia O'Keeffe, Marcel Duchamp, Gertrude Stein, and Eugene O'Neill. DeMuth Museum Executive Director Ann Lampe says these experiences helped shape DeMuth's artistic vision.
He lived in Lancaster all his life, but traveled in very avant-garde intellectual circles in Philadelphia, New York, London, Paris. He took the most avant-garde ideas of the day, and they were emanating out of Europe, and brought them back to America and applied them to the subject matter of Lancaster and everything he found here.
DeMuth is known for his skillful and imaginative use of watercolors, especially his paintings of flowers from his mother's garden, which he could see from his second-floor studio. DeMuth Museum visitors can explore both the restored garden with its original brickwork and DeMuth's studio space in which he spent so much time.
Today you can still see the tile in the gallery, but he came through the bathroom and back in here to his studio, and he was secluded. It had three windows so he could look out into his mother's garden and the Trinity.
DeMuth is also known for being at the forefront of developing a style of painting known as Precisionism, an art movement strongly influenced by Cubism, and often focusing on the industrialization and modernization of the American landscape. For instance, Ann Lampe says DeMuth would take something very commonplace, like a flower.
And he would create planes and lines. If you know Picasso's Cubism, how he creates planes out of everything. And so cutting things into planes and different forms, which are called rays. So it sort of looks like light coming through a stained glass window, cutting across a picture.
Two of DeMuth's most well-regarded paintings were created in this style, the descriptively titled Figure 5 in gold and My Egypt, which in particular reflects the inspiration that the city of Lancaster provided for DeMuth. The 1927 painting features two once prominent grain towers in downtown Lancaster. Other paintings feature the city's Lutheran church steeple, a feed mill sign, a water tower, and chimneys. Anne Lampe says works like these synthesized what was going on in America at the time.
Here in Lancaster, we forget what a bustling city this was, with the trolleys and the streetcars going up and down, and the electricity wires were coming. But yet you could go a half mile and you were in a farm. So he was really exploring this transition in American society between an agrarian culture and becoming an industrialized culture.
Lampe says this exploration made him a leader of early American modernist art, a painter that influenced artists to come, pop artists like Andy Warhol and Robert Indiana. Tom Cook, a Lancaster-based art collector and enthusiast, says in paintings like My Egypt at the Whitney Museum, DeMuth taught so many how to look at mundane things in a fresh way.
The grain towers that were mentioned, I went to the Whitney and I was blown away by his imaging of, you know, things that I took for granted that I drove by every day. And I think that an artist can show us how to see something in a totally new and different light.
Due to the widespread reverence for DeMuth's work today, many of his well-known pieces are on display in galleries and museums outside of Lancaster. But that's not to say that the DeMuth Museum collection is unimportant. With 32 DeMuth pieces, only the Barnes Foundation in Marion, PA, and the Museum of Modern Art in New York feature more of his works. Even so, the strength of the museum in Lancaster is the opportunity to see the house DeMuth called home, the studio in which he created, and the buildings and garden that provided so much inspiration for his paintings. With the foundation's historical artifacts, library archives, and art collection, DeMuth Museum leaders want to continue developing the institution into being what they call DeMuth Central, a must-see destination for any serious student and admirer of Charles DeMuth. The old adage of the prophet being honored anywhere but in his hometown may at one time have been appropriate for Lancaster, but now the foundation and museum that bears his name is helping to ensure that Charles DeMuth is remembered and revered where he was born, lived, and died.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Next Saturday, the DeMuth Foundation and Museum in Lancaster will put on display, for the first time, its entire collection of DeMuth works. The exhibition will be on view through August 31st. This weekend, Philadelphia hosts a national convention about art. But most of the 1,400 attendees are not artists, but leaders of arts councils, agencies, and other arts groups. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis explores the issues that bring Americans for the Arts to Philadelphia for their annual national event.
Few would argue with the idea that societies are enriched by the arts. Art can bring beauty to our lives. It can provide solace in times of trouble or challenge us to think in new ways. Science shows that arts activity can enhance cognitive skills, and a recent National Endowment for the Arts survey reports that more Americans identify themselves as artists than any other profession outside the military. The Philadelphia region boasts art in all forms, from classical music to jazz to hip-hop, from traditional fine arts to video and sound installations, with numerous productions of opera, theater, and dance. Art can be found inside museums, galleries, and academic institutions, as well as outside in parks, on sidewalks, on the walls of homes, and the sides of bus shelters. But for a community to have a lively art scene, it needs not only artists and audience, but also those who advocate for the arts.
America is a very practical nation. We have to remember that we come from Puritan roots. The Puritans outlawed dance, they outlawed theater, they even outlawed certain colors.
Bob Lynch is president and CEO of Americans for the Arts, the national organization dedicated to making the arts accessible to people in every American community.
The practical nation has not necessarily fully embraced the concept that the arts are an inherently important value that should be in everyone's lives, and more importantly, that should be publicly supported. That's why we see arts education often cut, and that's why public support for the arts is important but not huge in America, not like it is in other countries.
Lynch's organization has been working to mobilize this support for nearly 50 years, with a continuing vision to connect all of the arts with all of the people. In the early 60s, it lobbied to create an infrastructure of arts councils on the local, state, and national level, something that Lynch says fell into place in 1965 with the formation of the National Endowment for the Arts.
Because of the way the policy was written, which said that any state that had a state arts council could get matching money from the federal government, it basically overnight created the 50 state arts councils, where there had only been four prior to the creation of the National Endowment for the Arts.
In addition, there are now over 5,000 local arts councils, like the Greater Philadelphia Cultural Alliance, host to this weekend's convention, the theme of which is American Evolution, the Arts in the New Civic Life. Cultural Alliance President Peggy Amsterdam says Philadelphia has a good record of making the arts part of its civic discourse.
Last mayoral elections, you saw every one of the candidates talking about arts and culture on their platform. It was a major issue here. One of the things that we're looking at is creating a dialogue across the country about why the arts are important to the new civic life. And this is obviously to make some impact in the presidential elections.
The gathering is a chance for arts leaders to strategize and share ideas about how to better support and advance the arts in their communities, ways to show that art is valuable not only for art's sake, but as an engine of economic development. Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation CEO Merrill Levitz says the relationship between tourism and the arts is mutually beneficial.
I think the arts institutions, both performing arts and visual arts, have become more expansive. They've needed to engage new audiences, and as Philadelphia has become more of a tourist and convention destination, they've also seen more possibility to do this with a transient population that wasn't here before.
The Tourism Corporation's campaign called You Wish You Knew is a web blog site aimed at a computer-savvy urban audience whose interests go beyond conventional fare. Levitt says arts groups going after new audiences must also think creatively.
Making it alluring and accessible, educating them along the way, but broadcasting an appeal that takes into account a prospective audience's possible interest other than the original reasons for why the artist put it out there. I mean, you can control the experience, but so long. And I think a little less interest in control and a little more interest in invitation would be a lovely step for us all.
Keeping the community in mind is at the heart of the work of artist Pepon Osorio, a 1999 MacArthur Genius Grant recipient who also teaches at Temple University. The Puerto Rican-born Osorio is renowned for his installations, in which he often engages the neighborhood in telling a story.
I use art as a way of channeling the community and people's voices. My goal is to find a happy medium of where I stand and the people that I work with and collaborate with in the community, where they stand. And I think that happy medium becomes the piece itself. I don't normally think of art as an object. I think of it as a process. And often the process is much more important than the product.
A former social worker, Osorio sees art as a catalyst for getting people to talk with one another and think creatively about their lives. His work, Badge of Honor, is one example. In a storefront space 26 feet wide, he recreated a jail cell of a father side by side with the bedroom of his son. Traveling between jail and the home, Osorio recorded thoughts and responses between father and son about subjects like love and separation. With portraits of the father and son on opposing walls, he played the recording of the voices back and forth. The art, he believes, struck a nerve in the community.
I think this conversation is something that has stayed in people's mind for a long, long time. The conversation between the father and son, it's very, very, very deep. It allows other people to think about themselves in ways that they haven't before. To me, that's just more than enough for an intervention. If it works as a work of art, and it has all the aesthetics and all the different formal issues that are required in a work of art, that's a plus.
Osorio says public art, like that in the midst of a neighborhood, can tap into a community's emotional core.
Because you somehow emotionally own the work of art that it's in the public. It has a significant primetime space in the evolution of in your evolution as a being and as a citizen.
The connection between art and citizenry is also key to Americans for the Arts. Now that the infrastructure of arts councils has been created, Bob Lynch says the organization aims to make art education more visible and create more arts leaders, including citizens.
We will send the citizen activist members messages about political action that needs to be taken. For example, that the National Endowment for the Arts budget is before Congress for a vote, and we would like you to contact your congressperson, which is very, very important for helping Congress decide that this is something that the citizens value.
And so, during this three-day weekend, arts leaders of all stripes will set their stars on the role that the arts can play in the continuing story of America. Keynote speakers include former Al Gore campaign manager Donna Brazile and trend spotter Andrew Zolli. Innovators like Merrill Levitz and Pepon Osorio will also share insights, and visitors will visit cultural landmarks and artistic treasures. What will the participants take home? Perhaps fresh ideas about art and the way to promote it. New tools for demonstrating the power of art to change lives and lift up communities. And a renewed resolve to keep arts in the schools, on the platform of every political candidate, and the agenda of every elected leader.
WRTI Susan Lewis. The Americans for the Arts Convention, American Evolution, Arts and the New Civic Life, continues through tomorrow at various locations throughout Philadelphia. And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Karen Jenkins, Cassandra Orrell, and John McInerney. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.